start with one of the first Rashis in the Sedra. Pasuk says, "Vayidaber Elokim el Moshe, vayomer elav ani Hashem, vo'eiro el Avraham, el Yitzchok ve'el Yaakov bekel Shakai." Rashi adds what seems to be totally unnecessary in explaining this pasuk. Rashi says, "Vo'eiro el ha'avos, I appear to the avos." Now it says in the pasuk who the Rabban Shalom appeared to Avraham, Yitzchok, and Yaakov. Why in the world would we think that there's somebody else and not the avos? What does Rashi add by telling me that the Rabban Shalom appeared to the avos? It's me now that I'm speaking about this, and maybe in Parshas Vayechid, we speak about the bracha of Ephraim and Manasseh and speak about this Rashi, any chance? No, you don't remember? Okay. I don't think we did. In any case, we could have spoken about it then, but I don't think so. Okay, so we'll speak about it now. That's the first question. What is Rashi adding that I don't know from the Pasuk telling me that Avraham, Yisrael, and Yaakov are the Avos? Secondly, Rashi says, so what is the Taina? What's the Rabban Shem telling Moshe Rabbeinu? He's saying that I used to have some very nice people in this world, that I promised them many things. They never saw the fulfillment of the promise. In fact, they saw just the opposite. I promised Avraham Avinu that he would inherit Eretz Yisrael, and he had to buy a burial plot for Sarah Imenu at an exorbitant fee. And he never complained and never questioned me. And you, Moshe Rabbeinu, the first time I tell you something, and I tell you you're going to redeem the Jewish people, and it doesn't go exactly as you planned, right away you have tainus. Loma hariosa loma ze, loma ze shlachtoni. Why'd you do bad to them? Why'd you send me? Chaval al da'avdin velo mishtachit. It's a shame that they're lost and can't be found. Two questions. First of all, what's the Taina on Moshe Rabbeinu? There's a famous story with the Rebbe Reb Zusha. The Rebbe Reb Zusha once said that if after 120 years, the Beis Din Shalmala asks me, how come you weren't as great as the Baal Shem Tov? I'll say I didn't have the potential to be the Baal Shem Tov. They asked me how come I wasn't as great as the Rambam. I'll say I didn't have the potential to be the Rambam. You know what I'm afraid of? They're going to ask me how come I wasn't like Zusha. And that I had the potential to be, that scares me. You can't demand from someone just because somebody else can do something, they can do it too. That's not a fair demand of someone. You have to demand that they're not living up to their potential. But how come you're not like somebody else? That's not a tain on a person. Usually I don't bring questions from Chassidus or Maisalach, but Lamaisa, it's true. I mean, it seems, even though there's a Gemara that seems to contradict that, the Gemara says that Hillel Mechayev Eso Aniyim, and Rabbi Lezer Mechayev Eso Ashirim, and Yosef Mechayev Eso Arishoyim, that when a person comes to Din and he says that he was too poor to learn Torah, we'll tell him, but Hillel was very poor, and he learned Torah. So it seems like we are demanding from a regular person who was poor to be like Hillel. So I think the meaning over there is different. We're not saying that you should be like Hillel. Hillel was poor, he learned. You were poor, you could have learned too. What we're saying is the following. Poverty can't be the excuse, because there were poor people who learned. So if you're looking for an excuse, look for a different one. Maybe you weren't as great as Hillel, but poverty can't be the reason why you can't learn Torah, because there were poor people who learned. So if you have an excuse, okay, you weren't on that level, whatever, but don't tell me because you were poor, because poverty can't be the excuse. That's what that Gemara means. But here we're saying to Moshe Rabbeinu, the Rabban Shalom saying, I had great people in this world that I promised things, they never questioned me, how come you're not like them? I'm not like them, because I'm not like them. I'm not on the madrig of the avos. The avos were higher than me. Moshe Rabbeinu is a very easy answer. The second question is, It says, Chaval al da'avdin velo mishtachin. It's a shame they're lost and can't be found. Obviously, if they're lost, they can't be found, because if they could be found, they wouldn't be lost. So why do you have to say both? It's a shame they're lost and can't be found. And thirdly, are the avos really lost and can't be found? I know where they are. Their bodies are in Marsa Machpelah, and their neshamas are in Gan Eden. Why are they lost? Why can't they be found? What does that mean? Chaval al da'avdin velo mishtachin. The Rabban Shem knows very well where they are. In order to answer all of this, I'm going to explain the following to you. The term avos does not mean fathers in its simple sense. Because Chazal say, Ein korin la'avos ala shlosha. You only refer to avos to Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov, and imahos to Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. No one else, even though there are fathers. But avos is the same connotation as avos hamalachos by Shabbos, lahavdil avos hatuma by tuma. The word av means a main category, a source. The source of Klal Yisrael are Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. That is the source, the av. Everything else is a tolda, everything else emanates from them. Whatever they were able to achieve, they created a spiritual gene pool, wellspring, reservoir of powers for Klal Yisrael. The Reb Chaim Volozhiner says in Pirkei Avos, in Ruach Chaim, the intention of the Asorah Nisyonos of Avraham Avinu was that Avraham Avinu, through his Asorah Nisyonos, created a reservoir of power for all Jews for all times, that if Avraham Avinu had not fulfilled those Nisyonos, no Jew would ever be able to do similar things. If Avraham Avinu was not able to fulfill the Nisayon of Lech Lecha and leave Chutz La'aretz and move to Eretz Yisrael, no Jew would ever be able to make Aliyah. When a Jew leaves Chutz La'aretz and moves to Eretz Yisrael, it's because he calls upon the power that Avraham Avinu created in the spiritual gene makeup of Klal Yisrael, that we have the power to do that. Had he not done it, we wouldn't have the power. Every Jew who ever sacrificed his life, his family, al kiddush Hashem, in all the generations, was because Avraham Avinu passed in the Nisayon of the Akedah. Had he not done that, no Jew would ever have the power to go al kiddush Hashem. So avos are not merely fathers. They created the spiritual makeup of the Jewish people. Maisa Avos Simen Labanim is one aspect of that. But the kochos of Klal Yisrael come from the Avos. And therefore, Rashi is answering the questions we asked by adding Vo'era El Ha'Avos. True, if I appear to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov as individuals, and they were able not to question me, to accept promises, not see their fulfillment, and not have questions, I wouldn't have a taina on you to say, how come you're not like those individuals? But Vo'era el Ha'avos, I appear to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Rashi says, as Avos, not as Stam individuals. And in the areas of the basics of Yiddishkeit, Emunah, Bitachon, they created the spiritual makeup of Klal Yisrael. And therefore, Chaval al da'avdin velo mishtachin, they should be found in you. Those powers should be found in you, and they're lost. I don't find them in you. They're lost and can't be found. Meaning, not that the avos are lost, but the powers that they created that should be in every Jew are lost in you and can't be found. They're there somewhere. They're not lost completely. They're there potentially, but I can't find them. I don't see them by you. They haven't come out yet. That's the taina. The taina is not why you can't be like an individual, a different individual. Taina is va'era el ha'avos. I appear to the avos, and those kochos should be by you. Okay. Any questions on that? That will. Okay. Yes.
The what?
Yeah, because it doesn't mean they're lost completely. It means that that potential exists in you. And at this point, it's lost in you and I can't find it. But it should be able to be found. It's there potentially. It's not lost forever. It's not that you don't have it. You have it, but it's not, you haven't accessed it. That's the idea. Agav, I don't remember if in Vayechi we spoke about the Baruch of Ephraim and Menashe. Did we? Okay, so they had a connection to this, that even future generations, Ephraim and Menashe, who didn't grow up in Eretz Yisrael, didn't grow up in the presence of the Avos, still had those kochos. And that's the bracha we give. Okay, let's go to something else. It says, sometimes it mentions Moshe before Aaron, and sometimes it mentions Aaron before Moshe. And Rashi brings down the Chazal, Malame Shishkulin Hein. They were equal. Moshe and Aaron were equal. Now, what does that mean, they were equal? They weren't equal. Lokom kemoshe, Aaron was not as great as Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu was the greatest Navi. Aaron never reached that level of Nevuah. Aaron was a Kohen who brought the Kohuna for his subsequent Doros. Moshe wasn't a Kohen. So what was Shkulin? They weren't equal at all. So there are two ideas. We have other things that say shkulin. It says shkula, Shabbos, keneged kol ha-mitzvahs. Shabbos is equal to all the other mitzvahs. So what does that mean? If you keep Shabbos, you don't have to keep other mitzvahs? If you keep all the other mitzvahs, you don't have to keep Shabbos? What does that mean? They're equal. Tzitzis. Shkula tzitzis, keneged kol ha-mitzvahs. So if you wear tzitzis, you don't have to keep mitzvahs? Some people say that seriously, for another chazal. Shkula Eretz Yisrael kechol ha-mitzvahs. That yeshivas Eretz Yisrael is equal to all the other mitzvahs. Some people say, therefore, if you live in Eretz Yisrael, you don't have to keep mitzvahs. Because living in Eretz Yisrael is equal to all the mitzvahs. But for that matter, if you wear tzitzis, you don't have to keep mitzvahs either. Because shkula tzitzis connected kol. What does that mean, shkula? So one idea of shkula is that all of the concepts of what mitzvahs represent are included in this. This is more like a mini example of all the mitzvahs. It's not equal to all the mitzvahs. If you keep Shabbos, you don't have to keep other mitzvahs. Or if you wear tzitzis, or if you live in Eretz Yisrael. But it means that it has aspects of all the mitzvahs in it. For instance, tzitzis. Tzitzis is a reminder to all the mitzvahs. So in that respect, it has in it something of all the mitzvahs. So it has a connection to all the mitzvahs. That's called shkula. Not that it's equal in weight. Equal in conception. Conceptions of the mitzvahs are contained in tzitzis. Shabbos also. If you don't keep Shabbos, it's like your kofer b'chol ha-Torah. So in order for all the mitzvahs to be valid, you have to have Shabbos with it. So Shabbos has something to do with all the mitzvahs. Eretz Yisrael is the only place you can fulfill all the mitzvahs. So you need Eretz Yisrael together with all the mitzvahs in order for them to be valid. So therefore Eretz Yisrael has in it something that connects to all the mitzvahs. That's called shkula. That's one idea. If that's the case, then Moshe and Aaron also. Moshe represented one aspect of Klal Yisrael, one kind of leadership, and Aaron represented a different kind of leadership. And you needed both of them to be able to have the full shlemus of leadership in Klal Yisrael. So each one had something to do with the other one because each one wasn't complete without the other one. It's like saying that the spark plug in a motor of a car is equal to the to the carburetor. Now, a carburetor is a lot more expensive than a spark plug. But if you're missing the spark plug, the motor won't work. And if you're missing the carburetor, it won't work. So So they're equally important because each one gives in something that the other one needs. Without tzitzis, you wouldn't remember the mitzvahs. Without Shabbos, the mitzvahs would be invalid. Without Eretz Yisrael, the mitzvahs wouldn't apply, all of them. So they're all equal shkulim because they're equally important, even though absolutely they're not equally equal. But they're equally important in the scheme of things. That's what it means. Moshe and Aaron were equally important in the scheme of things, even though Aaron was not equally important to Moshe Rabbeinu individually. That's one idea. Second idea is that the Rabbanu Shlom judges things according to their potential. And if somebody reaches 100% of their lesser potential, they are considered equal to somebody else who reaches 100% of their greater potential. A person's only expected to reach the potential that the Rabbanu Shlom gave them, and not everybody has the same potential. So you are judged as to how weighty you are, as to how much of your potential you reach. If Moshe reached 100% of his, let's say, 10-point potential, and Aaron reached 100% of his 8-point potential, they're equal. They're equally important. Because you're not judged on how much potential you have that the Rabbanu Shlom gives you. You're judged on how much of that potential you realize. And in that respect, they were equal. Okay. Any questions on that? Yes.
So, but according to what was said before about the Avos giving everyone the same, like, of the spiritual gene.
It doesn't mean everybody can be Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. What it means is there are certain basics of Yiddishkeit. Right? I said it quickly, but it's good that you asked it. There are certain basics of Yiddishkeit, emuna, bitachon, or whatever, mesiris nefesh, right? The ability to plug into Eretz Yisrael. Those things are what we inherit from the Avos. Not every bit of potential, everything that Avraham Avinu, Yitzchak, or Yaakov was, can we be. It says, Mosa Yadgiyu Maisei. Every Jew has to say, Mosa Yadgiyu Maisei L'Maisei Avosai. It doesn't say, Mosa Yiyu Maisei. When will I be like Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov? That's absurd. But Mosa Yadgiyu Maisei means, when will my deeds reach out and meet their deeds? In other words, in certain areas, I have the potential that the Avos created for me. When will I develop that potential that is passed on? Right, there are certain things even in physical genetics. Right, person's not a carbon copy of his parents, but there are certain genes that are passed on, and in that area you are similar. You have a similar makeup to your parent. That's what we're talking about.
Everyone
has certain things that are passed on that he has the potential of what the Avos created. In general, you can't be exactly like the Avos in everything.
We all have the same basic potential, and then
in certain things, in certain things, and then everybody has their own unique potential.
So then saying that Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe and anyone else who was a Jew at that time had this basic level of potential, then Moshe obviously went over that. But Hashem
gave Moshe more potential in certain areas. He had more potential in Nevuah than any other person. But that he didn't get from the Avos per se. That he got is Moshe Rabbeinu.
But here the potential that Hashem says
to not question him, right, that comes from the Avos. That every Jew has. The potential, that's a quality that every Jew has. It may not have the same intensity of it, but the quality is there. And if you totally don't use that quality, then something's missing, because you have the quality. You have the ability on some level. That's the idea. Okay, and that's why Moshe Rabbeinu, it says, Moshe Rabbeinu was onav mikol ha'adam asher al pneihu adam. Moshe Rabbeinu said, the Rabbanu Shem gave me tremendous potential. Maybe I'm not living up to my tremendous potential as much as people who are on the face of the earth. They're down there. They weren't given the potential I was given and brought up to Shemayim. Maybe they're developing more of their lesser potential than I'm developing of my more potential. And therefore, they're on a higher level than me. Because you're not judged on the potential. That's God's doing. You're judged on how much of the potential you realize. Yes. That's Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam has many meanings, but it's not necessarily the same thing as Shpulim. It's a different idea. So at some point in the year, we'll discuss it. But let's get to some more things in the Sedra. Okay. The Ribbono Shel Olam hardens Paro's heart. Chizuk Leiv Paro. Remember what we're going to speak about now, because we're probably going to speak about it again either next week or the week after that. In fact, when do we stop because of your tests, midterms?
Another 2 weeks.
Another 2 weeks?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Okay. So we'll probably speak about it either next week or the week after that as part of another discussion. But we're going to use what we're going to say now, so remember. The Ribbono Shel Olam hardened Paro's heart. What was the purpose of it? Why? The Rambam says that it was part of Paro's punishment. He took away his free choice. The first five makos, it says that Paro hardened his own heart. So Chizuk Lev Paro really didn't take effect until the sixth makah. And then it says that the Ribbono Shel Olam hardened Paro's heart. The Ribbono Shel Olam, the Rambam says sometimes people can reach a level where they deserve to be punished, and the Ribbono Shel Olam takes away their free choice, does not allow them anymore to do tshuva, and uses them as a pawn for his purposes. That's what happened to Paro. Paro was not punished for denying and refusing to let the people go after the sixth makkah. He was punished for everything that happened up until then. And everything after that, he had no more free choice, and the Ribbono Shel Olam used him to be Mekadesh Shem Shamayim. And even though that may seem not fair, because everybody has free choice, if you don't have free choice, what are you being punished for? But it's very simple. Would it be easier for you to understand that God killed Paro after the sixth makkah? If he was dead, he didn't have free choice anymore. And he would be punished for everything he did up until that point. So the only difference is that God didn't kill him. He took away his free choice. As if he was dead. He just let him live because he wanted to use him. But for all practical purposes, had Paro died at that point and got punished for everything up to that point, we'd understand it. So instead of killing him, the Ribbono Shel Olam let him continue living, took away his free choice. It's as if he was dead. Everything he would be punished for was for what came before this, when he had free choice. And everything after that, instead of having a dead body, the Ribbono Shel Olam permitted him to continue living and used him for his purposes. That's the Rambam. So the Rambam says that Paro's hardened heart was really taking away his free choice. Sfarno and others say just the opposite. That the Ribbono Shel Olam was concerned that Paro have free choice up till the end. And as the makkos got more intense and accumulated, Paro really had no choice. A normal person faced with these makkos would have to say yes. He'd be forced to say yes. So therefore, the Ribbono Shel Olam hardened Paro's heart in order that he wouldn't be forced by the makkos to give in and he would maintain free choice. He still had the choice to say yes or to say no. Had God not hardened his heart, he would have had to say yes. And then he would have been forced to do it, and that wouldn't have been good. Because the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted Paro, if he's going to say yes, to do it on his own volition, not to do it because he was forced. So the purpose of hardening Paro's heart was not to take away his free choice, like the Rambam says, but just the opposite, to avail him that he should maintain his free choice. So that is a major machlokus in what the purpose of hardening Paro's heart was. Okay. Next. The Rabbanu Shalom, any questions on that? Hold it, because we're going to go into it. Yeah, let me tell you anyway. Yeah. It means that he gave him the courage and the ability to say no, to be stubborn enough to say no in light of the Makos. Because if he didn't have such a hard, stubborn, determined heart, right, more than what's normal, he would have been forced to say yes. That's what it means. Okay, the Pasuk says like this. The Rabbanu Shalom tells Moshe Rabbeinu, Ki yedaber aleichem paro leimor, when paro will speak to you saying, Tenu lochem mofes, give yourselves a wonder, V'yomartel Aaron, kaches matcho, v'hashlech lifnei paro yilosani. You should tell Aaron to throw his stick down, he'll turn it away to a serpent. Next pasuk, V'yavo Moshe v'Aaron al paro, v'yasuke, they did what Hashem said, kasher tzivu Hashem, now, the simple meaning of the pasuk doesn't seem to say that they did what the Rabbanu Shalom said. The Rabbanu Shalom said, if Paro will say to you, give yourselves a wonder, then you should throw the stick down. It says they went into Paro and they did what Hashem said. They threw down the stick. Nobody asked them. God made a contingent, seemingly, and when Paro will say to you something. It doesn't say they went into Paro. He said, give me a sign, and they did it. So some say simply, it says they did what God said, means that Paro originally asked, and then they did it. And if the Torah just, being Mekatzer, the Torah just said it in a succinct way, that they did what God said, means that Paro asked them. Doesn't seem like that. Also, the language is difficult. Paro should have said, Tnu limo face, give me a sign, give me a wonder. Prove to me that you have credentials. Tnu lochemo face means give yourselves a wonder. What do they need? They're doing it for Paro's sake, not for their sake, seemingly. Simple answer to that means, Paro says, give yourself credentials. You want to talk to me? Then you better have good credentials. You better be able to do something wondrous. So give yourself a wonder. Give yourself some kind of credentials to be able to argue with me. But I want to think that maybe it means something different. And that's the following. Ki yedaber aleichem paro. When you will come face to face with Paro, that leimor, that will say to you, give yourselves a wonder. Meaning the following. A person is very much influenced by their surroundings. It is part of the nature of a person to be influenced by other people. And that's why one of the reasons why it's usher to look in the face of a Russian, because it has to make an impression on you. If somebody can be so evil, so obstinate in their disbelief, it has to have ashpa on you. It's part of the nature of a person. It's not just something that could be. It is part of the makeup, the Rambam says, Derech Briyoso Shel Adam. It is the nature of a person, the way he's created, to be influenced by other people. It's not something, it's like putting your hand in the fire. You can't say, it won't affect me. It's natural. That's the way people were created. Fire burns your flesh. Other people influence you. It's part of the nature of a person. I don't know if we ever spoke about this Indian here. When you get to be my age, the years blend together. So you are like, for the last 20 years, people sitting here, some of your mother sat here. So I don't remember if it was this year that I spoke about it, or last year, or 20 years ago, or whatever. So I don't think so, though. So let me enlarge upon this a little bit just to tell you how serious, how much it's part of human nature, and why it's like that. The Rambam says again, Derech Briyoso Shel Adam. It's not just something that could happen. It's not just something that is a phenomenon that sometimes happens. It is part of the nature of a human being to be influenced by other people. It has to happen. It doesn't necessarily mean it happens overtly, immediately. You move to a place where people are ganovim, next day you're going to steal. doesn't mean that. But what it means is it has an effect on you. It has an effect to the point where you become insensitive eventually to stealing, where it affects you that it's not something that you're careful about anymore. It works in very, very subtle and gradated ways, but it has to have some effect. It's impossible it shouldn't have an effect on you. It's an interesting Migdal Oz. How did the Rambam know that? He knew it as a physician. How did he know that it's part of the nature of a person? It's obvious that people are influenced by things around them. How did the Rambam know that it's part of the very nature of the person? So the Migdal Oz says that the source of this Rambam is a Gemara that you're all familiar with, but as a song, not as a Gemara. The Gemara is the following, and the Migdal Oz says the source of that of this Rambam, that a person is influenced by his very nature, is the following Gemara. The Gemara is a Gemara in Ksubas. The Gemara starts with a question, Ketzad Maragdin Lefnei Akala. And it's not Arthur Murray dance lessons, right? Doesn't have little footsteps in the Gemara of how to dance in front of the Kala. Rashi says it means, what do you say to the Kala that the dancing will really make them happy? The way of making the Kala and the Chosen happy is to praise the Kala in front of the Chosen that he should hear and be reinforced with the fact that he made a good choice. So you praise the Kala in front of the Chosen while you're dancing to show that you really mean it, and that is the mitzvah of Simchas Chosen v'Kala. So Kate, what do you say? So Beis Shammai says, Kala kamo shehi. You say the Kala is as she is. And there are three interpretations of Beis Shammai. The most extreme interpretation of Beis Shammai is you say exactly what you think, the truth, as you see it. In other words, if you think the Kala is an ugly witch with no midos tovos, and the Chassan says, what do you think about my Kala? You say, I think she's an ugly witch with no midos tovos. Now, you don't have to go to the wedding. You can stay by the smorgasbord, right? But if you're asked, you must say the honest truth that you think. That's the most extreme opinion in Beis Shammai. The second interpretation of Beis Shammai is you should find something nice about the Kala you also think is nice. You may think she's an ugly witch with no midos, but if the Chassan says, what do you think about my Kala? You say, oh, I think her shoes fit beautifully. Right? So you found something nice about the Kala. You didn't lie. There's something nice about everybody, right? And you said what's true in your eyes. That's the second interpretation of Beis Shammai. And the third is you say those words. The Kala is as she is. Now, you have your meaning in that, and he hears it. By the way, he wants to hear it, and everybody's happy, and nobody lied. We don't pass him like Beis Shammai, right? We pass him like Beis Hillel. Beis Hillel says, you always say Kala no v'chasuda. She is a charming and beautiful Kala. So Beis Shammai says to Beis Hillel, nice guys, right? Every Kala is charming and beautiful. What if she's not charming and beautiful? How do you have a permission to lie? When the Torah said, Midvar Sheker Tirchuk, supposed to say far away from lies. How do you have a right to lie? She's not charming, she's not beautiful. You're lying through your teeth. How do you have a right to do that? So Beis Hillel answers Beis Shammai with another question. They say if somebody went to the shuk, and they bought something really horrendous. I used to like to give the example, it doesn't exist anymore. They stopped doing it years ago. They used to sell in Geula on Fridays paintings. The paintings were sold on the street corners. They were marked 100 shekel with a big X over it and 50 shekel, as if they started out 100 and now they're mamash reduced 50%. The paintings were meant for husbands who were shopping there on Friday, who would think that they're bringing their wife something really nice for Shabbos. Now, these paintings were so horrendous that no woman would ever hang them with the painting side facing the people. Right? Maybe with the painting side facing the wall. Maybe. And usually what happened is that husbands who have no idea what's nice and what's not nice, right? And they were convinced that they got a real bargain because it's 50% off, right? Really, the thing was worth about 10 shekel and it was hiked up to 50, right? But that's what they... So they would buy these things, bring them home. Their wives would say, take that immediately back. And they could never find the people who were selling it, because as soon as they sold the painting, they picked up and went to another street corner because they knew the guy would be back within half an hour to return it. So these were horrendous things. So somebody bought one of these paintings, is on his way home, and he shows it to you. And he asks you, what do you think? There's nothing you can do about it. He can't return it. There's nothing he can do. He's stuck with the painting. What should you say, say Beis Hillel? You should tell him how terrible it looks, or make him feel good. What's it going to hurt? He can't return it. There's nothing that can be. Make him feel good. That's not a lie. That's being nice. No, he wants a call. He's going home anyway. Whatever you tell him, he thinks this is great. I remember, personally, when I was much younger, I once saw some jewelry that was really on sale. That's what really interested me. But it looked really, really nice. So I bought it for my wife. And I gave it to her, and she received it, wow, like she was waiting for this for her whole life. And about 2 weeks later, one of my teenage daughters, who's now a mother of her own teenage daughters, came to me and she said, Tati, never buy mommy something like that again, and you are to never buy jewelry for our mother unless we're there to help you. I said, Miriam, what are you talking about? You know that your mother took this, and I thought that she had been waiting this for her whole life, the way that she looked at it when she got it. She said, did you ever see her wear it? I said, no, I thought she was waiting for like some special occasion to put it on. She said, she'll never wear it. That was fit for a 9-year-old. I wouldn't wear that. Right? A 9-year-old little girl may wear that. Beyond that, forget it. That was some little like bears or something. I thought it was exquisite. So don't tell me that you would save it from her, from his wife. It wouldn't help. Believe me. In any case, since then, I never buy any jewelry for my wife at all. This is my excuse. No, without my daughters being there. In any case. So that's what Beis Hillel said. What's it going to help? He can't return it. It's not going to help anything. Make the guy feel good. What's so terrible? Same thing over here. What are you going to tell him? The collar's an ugly witch who has no midos. If he asked you before he went out, maybe. But now's not the time. It's his wedding night. He's not divorcing her tonight. He's married already. What's it going to hurt to say, Kala no v'chasuda? And then the Gemara ends with the following. Mikan omru chachamim. From here the rabbis learned. From here they said, La'olam teheidaito shel other mureves and mabrios. A person should always be mixed in with other people's feelings, meaning be sociable. Be sociable. Don't be a party pooper and tell somebody that his kala is, who he's just married, is an ugly witch. Without me, they'll say she's a kala nova chasuda. What's it going to hurt? That's seemingly the Gemara. End of the Gemara. Do you see anywhere a hint to this Rambam? That a person is influenced by his very nature? It doesn't seem to be anywhere there. That's the Gemara. And the Migdal Oz says this is the source of the Rambam. Therefore, I think the Migdal Oz learned this completely different. And he learned the following. Beis Hillel never answered the question, how do you lie? How are you allowed to say Kala no v'chasuda if you think she's an ugly witch? Says the Gemara, Mikan omru chachamim, the rabbis learn from here. Not that you should be sociable. That's the way that most people learn this Gemara. La'olam te daito shalom murevis mabrius. It's a command. You should always be sociable, mixed in with other people. I think the Migdal Oz learned that the Rambam learned those words differently. Mikan omru chachamim, from here the rabbis deduced. La'olam, it is a fact of nature. The das shal adam murevis mabrius. A person's mind is mixed in with other people's minds. You can't avoid it. It's part of nature that you are affected by how other people think. And therefore, the chassan obviously thinks she's not an ugly witch. He thinks she's a kala no v'chasuda. He wouldn't have married her otherwise. And since by nature a person is affected by how other people think, somewhere in your mind you've been affected too by his opinion. And therefore it's not a lie. You may not think that consciously, but it's impossible that it shouldn't make an impression how he thinks, and therefore somewhere in your psyche, you've been influenced by him, and you can say, Kala no v'chasuda. That's how they learned, the Rambam, the Migdal Oz at least, says the Rambam learned this Gemara. That's what I think he means. So it's part of nature. Therefore, the Rabban Shem said to Moshe the following, Ki yedaber aleichem paro, when you're going to go and face Paro face to face and talk to him, Lamor, that's going to say to you, you better give yourself a miracle to strengthen yourself. Because you're going to be affected by Paro. Looking in the face of someone who is such an atheist, such a denier, right, it's going to affect you. And you're going to need for yourself a miracle to strengthen yourself. Not for his sake, for your sake. So when Paro will speak to you, that will tell you, not that Paro will say to you, Tnu lachem, give yourselves a miracle to strengthen yourselves because you're inevitably going to be affected by looking in Paro's face and coming face to face with somebody who is such a stubborn atheist. That is, it has to make an impression on you. And if it makes an impression, you need to strengthen yourself. So Tnu lachem mofeis, throw down the stick and see who's in control of this world for yourselves, not for him, for yourself. That's the, I think, a possible explanation. Next, the Gemara says, Maro Hananya Mishol Vazarya. What did Hananya Mishol Vazarya see that enabled them to jump into their fiery furnace of Nebuchadnezzar? They made a kal v'chomer from the tzvardim, from the frogs. If frogs have no free choice, they don't get rewarded, they don't get punished, yet they were mekadesh shem shamayim, because some of the frogs went into the ovens when they were burning, when they were ready to be baking. And they were moser nefesh on kiddush Hashem, then we must certainly have to do it too. So everybody asks, I mean, if Hananya, Mishael, Azariah had to do it, what did they learn from the frogs? What did they need the frogs? Either the halacha was they had to die al kiddush Hashem, or the halacha was they didn't. If the halacha was they didn't, what does the frogs make a difference? And if the halacha was they did, why did the frogs make a difference? Either way, do what's right. Why did they learn from the frogs? One answer is, it says that there are basically two ways to come to Yiras Hashem. One way is by learning Torah. The Rambam says that in Sefer HaMitzvot, that the way to come to V'yohavta Hashem Elokecha is V'hoyu hadvarim ho'eila shonochi mitzavcha ayom alavavecha. You come aware and acquainted with God's mind through the Torah. In the second way, the Rambam says in Yad Chazaka, in Mishneh Torah, the way to come to Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem is by observing nature. When you see nature, from the smallest bria, from the smallest part of the physical world, material world, to the greatest stars, and you realize the wisdom and the vastness of the Ribbono Shel Olam's knowledge and ability, you become overawed with a tremendous love for God and a tremendous awe and fear. And both are necessary. The Torah gives you direction, because if you don't have Torah first, then the Torah says by looking at nature you can come to the opposite of Emunah and Yira and Ava. You can come to Kfira. Pentisoi necho ha-shamayma v'ro'iso ha-shemesh v'yaseyoreach v'yasakuchavim v'nidachto v'istachavislam. You come to Avodah Zorah from studying nature. Yet the Rambam says you'll come to Avas Hashem from studying nature. So which is it? The answer is very simple. Depends what you're looking for. The first Soviet cosmonaut, Yuri Gagarin. I remember I was in high school when they sent up the first Sputnik with a human being inside. He made three orbits of the Earth and came down in the sea. First human being out of the gravitational pull of the Earth. That's it. He didn't go to the moon. He just escaped the gravitational pull of the moon and became a satellite of Earth for three orbits. That was it. When he came out of his Sputnik, he made the following idiotic statement, which probably he was told to do by the communist government. He said, now I know for sure there isn't a God. I didn't see him. That's what he said. Now, he didn't reach the ceiling. Right? There was a lot of space still to go. He just got out of the gravitational pull of the earth. So maybe God, he was expecting to see some old man on a throne, you know, floating up there, and he didn't see him. Maybe he was a few feet up. That's absurd. But that's what he said. I'm sure now there isn't a God. I didn't see him there. So he got from his space experience, atheism. On the other hand, there was a group of American astronauts. I don't remember, it was in the 70s. And they were going to the moon, not to land on the moon, it was before the moon landing, to go around the moon. Oh, no, the moon landing was in 1969, so it was in the 60s. And what they did was they beamed back to Earth via satellite. So everybody in the entire world saw these pictures at the same time if they tuned in. Pictures of Earth from space. How the Earth looks from their vantage point up there. And before they beamed the pictures, they read Tehillim, Yud Tes, Hashamayim Misaprim Kvod Kael, right? Hashamayim Misaprim Kvod Kael, what was the next pasuk? No, Hashamayim Misaprim Kvod Kael, Umayse Yodav Magid Harakia. That's what they said. And the whole thing in English. Goyim. Tremendous Kiddush Hashem. Tremendous Kiddush Hashem. So these Goyim, right, saw Yad Hashem from their space experience. And this Goy saw atheism. It depends what you're looking for. So first you have to have Torah to give you guidance to know how to look at nature properly. But once you have the Torah, you still need nature. Because we are human beings who are impressed by what we see, what we feel, what we sense with our five senses. That's more real to us than what we intellectually know. And I think I gave you an example to that, or maybe it was in the other class, in the second class, of the difference between intellectually knowing something and really experiencing and feeling it. The example they gave in the yeshiva that I went to in Tells was the following. In America, used to be, I don't know if it still is, the park benches are painted with a certain green paint that I think they must have had millions of gallons of that paint and never used it up. Every park in America has a certain green paint that they paint park benches with. When the park benches are painted, they put a sign that says wet paint. When you walk into the park and you see the sign on the park bench, wet paint, and you see the bench glistening, what is the knee-jerk reaction of most people? Touch the bench and look at your finger to see the green paint on your finger. Why? Don't you believe signs? It says wet paint. It's glistening. Why do you have to touch it and look at your finger to see the wet paint to be convinced that it's wet? The answer is because when you see it, you intellectually know that it's wet paint. But when you see it on your finger and you feel it, you know that it's different. There's a difference between knowing something intellectually and actually experiencing it and feeling it. We are human beings. We are affected by what our five senses feel. And therefore, seeing God's involvement in nature is more real to a person than just seeing it and intellectually in the Torah. The Torah gives you guidance to be able to see it properly in nature. So you need Torah and you need nature. Same thing over here. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah knew intellectually that they should jump into that oven, and they had a mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem. But when they made a kal v'chomer from the Tzfarim, they could see it in their mind's eye, the frogs jumping into the oven, even though they didn't see it in front of them. But they were able to see it in a more real way, not just an intellectual way. It made more of an impression on them. That's the idea. What you experience makes more of an impression than what you just know intellectually. So that's what Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were added to by being able to call upon the frogs in Egypt as a model for what they had to do. It made it more real to them. It gave them more of an incentive to do it than just the intellectual knowledge. Okay, I have quite a few more things, but I'll save it for some other time.